Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play podcast. Today we'll be featuring an interview from our Youth Leadership Online event that we originally hosted in December of 2018. The full event is available online on our website for loveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, sports leaders develop programs so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. We'd love to hear any feedback or comments down below, and please share this to others in your space so that we can all work together to bring the game back to the kids, because that's where it belongs. Hope you enjoy the chat and you get some great nuggets. Thank you. Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy from Paradigm Sports. Thanks for joining us for our Winter Summit hosted through our digital platform for the Love of the Game. Like we had in the summer, our winter list of speakers are just amazing. I'm really looking forward to our chat with our next guest is Dave Briglio. I actually had a conversation with him earlier this year when he asked me to be part of his podcast radio show, and looking forward to expand on that conversation. Dave Briglio is the director of Athletic Legacy Game Plan. He's the host of Making the Play radio show. He's also a coach, junior varsity in lacrosse. He's a coach development trainer for U.S. Lacrosse, associate trainer for Positive Coaching Alliance, and he does all of this while working 40 hours a week as an engineer. So his passion of love probably eats up as much time as his not-so-passion of love, and I'm really looking forward to our chat. Thanks for joining us, Dave. It's going to be great.
Yeah, thanks for having me here. I'm really excited about this.
And the first question I ask everybody, it doesn't matter who I'm talking to, is where did you grow up? And what sports did you play, whether they were free play or organized, when you were growing up?
Well, I grew up in Chicago. Originally, it was in the city. And for those who maybe who understand, I'm on the north side. You got to define if you're north side or south side. It depends on the neighborhood. But I grew up in baseball was my sport. And then winter comes along, so you play basketball, which is that's just what you do pretty much. Or you play something, you know, at the park you might play, I played floor hockey. We did wrestling, you know, we did all kinds of things, but baseball was my first love. And then as I got more into basketball, and I like that, but, Briglios don't grow very tall. So, you know, we've got a limited span on how long we can play basketball. When I got into, high school, I really liked basketball a lot, but I pushed baseball as hard as I could. Unfortunately, just kind of grew up in a town where they were state champions year after year. So I learned, to be honest, a lot about loving the sport for the sport, because there wasn't a lot of game time for me. We did pond ice hockey. We did that whenever we played 5-on-5, 4-on-4, 6-on-6 football, you know, at halftime for the Bears game, you know, at the local.
That's pretty cool.
School. We'd do whatever we needed to that. You know, we played a lot of sports, but in college I picked up lacrosse, strangely in the Midwest. But it was club level, as in if you have $50 and can buy the gear, you're on the team. And that became really truly a lifelong passion for me now, because my kids, my daughters picked up playing the sport. So lacrosse has come unexpectedly a really big thing, and I've now wound up in Maryland. So it's kind of funny how, you know, over 30 years, suddenly you end up at the center of all things.
And you picked up lacrosse, did I hear you right, like after high school when you went to college age group? So 18-ish?
Yep. 19, actually, and yeah.
So I'm going to ask the question before that I normally would ask at the tail end of this. Then what's your take on early sports specialization? Because you didn't specialize in lacrosse, obviously, and you played it later. What do you think about what led to you be able to pick up lacrosse at such a late age?
Oh, I can tell you what it was. It's because I played basketball, and it wasn't because of my jump shot. It's because I was taught the right footwork to play defense in basketball. That's honestly what it was. I also knew motion, you know, how to run a motion, a transition game. From baseball, I can catch and throw. I was an outfielder. So if a goalie was doing a long clear or there was a long pass, I could track it. I could hit somebody with it once I figured out how to use the stick. Right. And, you know, that, and I never even played a contact sport. That's the other thing. That was the hardest part. I had to learn, you know, the hitting, how to do that right. But I'm very much against it. I did live for 4 years in Jacksonville, Florida. And there's a problem when you have great sports weather year round. The kids will play sports year round. And what happens is there's no opportunity to change sports. So my one of my daughters, she, you know, when she was 9, declared herself to be, quote, athlete and wanted to change sports. But she couldn't a lot because she didn't have the hours. She may have the talent, but she didn't have the hours to keep up with the progression of other 6th and 7th graders. I mean, honestly, at that level, where when they had to make cuts, it just was simply the other kids have all been playing it year-round. And that bothers me a lot.
Yeah, and well, I mean, it's happening earlier and earlier and earlier now. Like, even though like hockey is a winter sport and really should only be played, and it's the longest season of any sports, which I can't believe that they go beyond the 8 months. But now it's spring hockey and summer hockey, and kids are starting to do that like at 6, 7, 8 years old, which is insane. And you wonder why, you know, the statistics, 70% of kids are quitting by 13. Well, they played their entire minor sports career by the time they're 12 because they went year round. So it's one of my biggest pet peeves in the space. And we could probably spend hours just talking about that one. So,
And the 10,000 hour rule, but we'll stop there because I think that's one of the biggest myths. I think that led to people thinking it was worthwhile.
Yeah, even Malcolm Gladwell has come up and said, hey, he didn't intend it to be the rule. And everybody thinks it's still being referenced. Like, I still can't believe that people talk about it. But it was just an observation done by Anders Ericsson. And then he's come out and said, you know, it's not just about that. It's about the deliberate practice, the feedback they're receiving from coaches, the importance of error correction. Princeton did a study on that whole concept. And practice only represents about 18% of what leads to you being an elite athlete. You got to think about there's psychology, there's nutrition, DNA, as you referenced earlier. I mean, Don Lucia does a great video that I share in hockey clinics. He goes, you know, if you're 5'7" and your wife's 5'3", you know, your kid's not going to play in the NHL unless the milkman came over, you know, like it's kind of an interesting, but you got to kind of keep that in perspective. So what was your fondest memory of all the sports that you played? Was it when you got to lacrosse, or did you have a fond memory? Like pond hockey for me was probably my fondest when I was growing up.
The funny thing is that my friends, we still talk about it because we're the 8 of us that knew each other going back to elementary school, Little League, some went to college together. We still keep in touch, but we always talk about pond hockey. And none of us played on – I take it back. 2 guys out of the 8 played on the school hockey team. The rest of us, we remember that. We bought used figure skates, you know, at garage sales. Then we, you know, graduated to buying a pair of Bowers. We would buy, you know, realized we were beating ourselves up falling so much that we realized, okay, we started buying, you know, other used hockey gear. And that's what we remember, to be honest, was going out there and switching the sides. I mean, sometimes we realized, okay, it's an uneven day. And we'd switch it to make it competitive. Or sometimes the losing team refused to give up, said, no, we're going to get it together. And we were very fierce competitors, but we're very brotherlike even now. I think of that the most. We played, you know, home run derby. You know, we were all baseball players.
Yeah.
But we would do things like that where we'd take a tiny little bat and we just would play 3-on-3. Home run derby. See, you know, guys diving, throwing, with nobody watching. Those honestly are my favorite memories. I can tell you, you know, things I remember from when I can tell you when my first hit was when I was 8 years old. I can tell you my first home run. I can tell you some things that I was, you know, so pleased to actually participate in lacrosse in college. But it comes back to those days with those guys when we were playing just to play.
Yeah, the whole camaraderie that you get out of that, best friends, like a lot of my best friends came out of all the sports they played, but mainly that the free play. Like we played a lot of pond hockey and or outdoor hockey when I grew up in Montreal. Then when I shifted to the West Coast, it was street hockey in the spring and summertime. Mm-hmm. And okay, we'd play maybe 4 hours in the morning and break for lunch, go to somebody's house, and then, oh, let's go play football in the park or baseball, whatever it was. The best thing that I remember about all those sports, the free play, there wasn't a coach, there wasn't a parent, there was nobody reffing. We made our own rules. We formed our own teams, like you said earlier. We rebalanced when we felt it was important to rebalance. But painfully, fast forward, you know, a generation later, you have things like, and I don't know if you got wind of it, but I just want to get your take on it. There was a game in Ontario recently, even because Hockey Canada has not rolled out cross-ice hockey for the novice age group, which is our 7 and 8 year old kids. They have for the 5 and 6 year old kids. And next year, cross-ice goes right across the country. So some provinces have rolled it out already. But because of that, there's a league in Ontario where they had a novice hockey game. Kids are 8 years old. And it was 41-0. 41-0. And on the scoreboard, it was 6-0. Kids know what the score was. And there was a big kerfuffle, you know, got into the papers, got some news in terms of video and stuff like that. And all I thought about right away when I saw the first article is, what about that goalie? What about that kid that was in the net for 41 goals? And no one mentioned it. No one even mentioned the goalies at all. And I've shared this anecdote with a few of the speakers for the summit, and everybody's kind of giving the same take. It's like, you know, that kid's never going to play goal again. I'd be surprised if he kept playing hockey. And then there was all the things, say, okay, the winning team, the team was up by a big margin. They tried things like changing the D for the forwards and stuff like that. Well, right away, I would have like called mercy the game, put the sticks in the middle, change some jerseys around, change the goalies, and let's just play for fun. They're 8. Like, yeah. What's your take on that?
I'll fast forward to one of my daughters playing high competitive high school club lacrosse, where sometimes they get the brackets wrong, you know, and there's a team that's on the cusp of being the top tier, and they just say, nope, you don't belong here. You belong in the lower one. And they outmatch the others.
Yeah.
And there is a point where I agree with this at that level. Again, these are 16-year-olds. The idea is, okay, we're not letting up, but we're not here to embarrass them. We're going to play our highest level. We're going to run our most complex plays. We are going to, you know, slow it up a little bit here and there, but we're not going to hold the ball for 6 minutes. That's an insult to that other team.
Yeah.
So, but again, those are 16-year-olds. That is, you know, a whole different way of going about it. And I think people use that of, well, how's the other team supposed to learn? Well, that's not the setting. Again, we take some of these phrases like, well, it's a disservice to not try your hardest against your opponent, up until the point where it is, like you say, it's really tearing them apart. There is nothing to be gained at all from that. Nothing. I mean, that's where, you know, offense goes to defense, defense goes to offense. You know, Everybody, you know, if we had, again, my JV team, great girls. I mean, but we did not go to the county championships. We had a game last game of the year. We played a team that only had 12. You need 12 to play. That's all they had. And even the players agreed. They said, okay, we're only going to do our best goals, not embarrassing behind the head shots. Mm-hmm. They said, okay, we are only going to run off a cut with a double feed, you know, something like that. If you have a one-on-one, don't shoot it. You got to find the feed, you know, draw the triple team. But even, you know, they understood that there was some respect for 15-year-olds, you know, that, and this was, again, the high school league, not club, but even they understood this is, you're going to tear that goalie apart. That goalie's got guts standing in there. So, you know, I bring it up, you know, I tell those two stories because, yes, there are exceptions. There are ways to go about it without just stopping and, you know, swapping jerseys. But at 8 years old, you're not even close to it. I mean, high school, there's a possibility you can find a way to not literally throw in the towel and scrap the game. But anything under 13, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's just parents may, again, I don't believe they're trying to tear a kid apart. I think they're taking some axiom out there and they're applying it to the worst of situations. and having outcomes they don't recognize.
And you've kind of touched on a couple of key points, the respect that really, you know, try to back off, ease off. And, you know, that gets into like the world junior level or stuff like that, where goal differential is important. And those coach, like I know the Team Canada coaches, when they go up against, you know, a team that really are at that bottom level of the tiering and they're having to run the score up on them. And it's like, we don't want to do this because it's class, right? You don't want to do that. You don't want to run a score up on a team.
Right.
And that whole concept of winning with humility and losing with dignity, how does these kids that are blowing out another team, regardless of what hockey or what sport it is, and they not excessively celebrate? Like I coach high school rugby, 15, 16, 17-year-old kids last year, and many of them had never played rugby before. They all wanted to get into the game. They wanted to try it out. Yeah, we were getting hammered. I mean, there's one game, it was 42-0 at halftime. The referee comes to me and he goes, what do you want to do? And I said, you know, let me talk to my players and say, hey, guys, you know, you want to keep going? And he goes, yeah. And we only had 15 players in a 15-on-15, and two of them got injured. So we ended up going with 13 guys. At the end of the game, the trainer of the other team comes to our bench to help out with one of our injuries. And he goes, that was the most amazing demonstration of heart I've ever seen. So yes, there's benefits of playing through the adversity, but only at that age when that makes sense. But at the younger ages, they should be playing for love, for passion. There shouldn't be a scoreboard as far as I'm concerned. And you look at countries like Norway, they don't compete until they're 13. So there's a reason why they're excelling at the Olympics, because they love sport and they keep going beyond that age group. So that kind of precursor the next question. When and why did you get into coaching?
Well, I got into coaching. I've got four kids, my four daughters, and the oldest got into gymnastics. So there's nothing you can do there as a parent. I mean, you drive them wherever it takes, and you watch, you know, biting your nails the whole way. That's a tough parent sport. But my second daughter, when she got to be about eight, she is now at 18 a very, very rabid athlete. But at the time, we honestly couldn't get her off the couch. And my wife said, you know, hey, I just saw here in Atlanta, where we were at the time, they've got girls lacrosse. And if you coach, I bet she'll go out there. And that's what it was for. It was to get her off the couch. I tell people that story now because she's 5'10", three sport, you know, athlete. And people are like, really? She wouldn't get off the couch? I go, no. I did it honestly as a service to get my kid to move. And I was scared to death because I was afraid of not helping the kids to win. Or worse, if I did, I would be too hard on them. I was very, very nervous. But thankfully, we had a rec group that said, no, we've got a group like Positive Coaching Alliance. They said, no, we're here to win, but not at all costs. And we're going to guide you and teach you. You don't have to worry. It's okay to want to win, but you will never, if you follow these rules, you will never sacrifice the kid. Right. And that's why I coach, because I found out how to keep my high competitive spirit up, but then to know, wait a second, we're crossing a line. You know, we're out of the black and white, we're in this gray, and it's about to get ugly if we push this score, this development of a player, any further. We're putting that ahead of the sport and what it does for kids.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And in the first few years you were coaching, did you get a lot of training, certification, or was it kind of thrown to the walls and just go for it?
Thankfully, this group really had it structured. In fact, it was a thing where, you know, okay, we've signed up, we've got the program, take the online 30 minute and you get a duffel bag. Okay. Do the 2 hour, you know, get this one done. And we've got this other, we got a backpack for, you know, or a shirt, but they actually went out of their way to put these incentives that adults were like, oh, okay. So that's cool. But then they followed around, and this is what I get into with things now, is if there's no follow-up, it doesn't matter what you read. It doesn't matter, you know, people, you know, this digital summit, that's great. You know, you've got these ideas, take them back to your organization. But if you tell people just watch this group, watch these two guys talk, you know, this group of people talk. That's not enough. There's got to be someone there in the moment. It's just like the players. And that was really what gave me the confidence to say, I'm going to love this. Like, I want the kids to win, but I don't want them to have some of the experiences I had. Because I'll say this, I probably only had the best and the worst coaches and, for that matter, supervisors in my career. You know, so I'm turning 50 this year. So you do the math. Since I was 6 or 7 years old, I haven't had a whole lot of mediocrity. So I've had a lot of contrasting. So I've felt, how do I live up to those great people, but not slip to the dark side, to those ones that just didn't get it? And I think it was because that first group, they had a structure in place. I mean, and hats off to them, because that's La Crosse and, you know, Central Georgia, again, not a hotbed, but they just were really, they understood what they wanted kids to get out of the sport. Any sport.
And that all comes down from the executive members and defining the importance of mentorship was key. That's basically what you got out of it, which in the U.S., you still don't have a centralized coaching program like we have in Canada with a national coaching certification program. So I know that there a lot of organizations are working on their versions thereof, but until that comes to, you know, nobody likes that word mandatory. I love the fact they were bribing you with backpacks and duffel bags. And it was like me when I started with hockey. Oh, you'll get a tracksuit if you become a coach. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. You know, but I never realized how big the time commitment was going to be. And like you, I had my day job and a lot of other people that I was coaching with, same thing. Volunteers, they all have to make a living so they can make a difference, right? So,
yeah, absolutely. And that is one of the things I've loved now about U.S. lacrosse. You know, I really just wanted to kind of keep doing things and helping out and learn to be a trainer because I like teaching and I wanted, and I realized how little help, even here in Baltimore, you know, and again, in the mid-Atlantic where lacrosse is a big deal and especially women's lacrosse, these parents don't have the support they need. And U.S. lacrosse has done really well with the athletic development model that soccer has been doing for some time now, which that it's that whole idea of, you know, letting the kids explore and discover and get some proficiency. And then, you know, they're even, we'll call it mastery, but at that step. And then you go to the next step, repeat again. What's the next thing to discover? And that has been a really big deal for me, to be honest. In fact, I use all those techniques in my technical job with young engineers, scientists. I use those same techniques with them.
Yeah, and it's amazing the crossover. A lot of people think that coaching is just specific to sport. Well, no. Coaching, and the best advice I got, I worked with an executive coach about 4 years ago because I knew I was kind of – I was just getting tired of the sales grind, you know, the travel. I've just 15 years sold all these major retailers all across the country. And I was like, you know, I've got to get out of this. I've got to do something different. And the best piece of advice she gave me is if you ran your business the way you coach your youth sports teams, your employees are going to thrive. And I'm like, I never thought of it in that perspective. I said, okay. So I started running my manufacturer's agency the same way. I had 3 people work for me at the time. And they were like, what happened? What did you do? I'm like, well, I just started coaching you instead of managing you. Like, it's just semantics, but same thing, right? We can transfer that over to non-sport. So shifting gears, and we'll just touch on this a little bit. What do you think the top 3 issues currently are facing youth sports, and what can we do to reverse them?
Okay. I wrote these down because my head exploded into a bunch of, you know, all the little things that we carry around. But I think it's the relationship. You know, I mentioned this before. Too many coaches are afraid to be their player's friend. Okay. You can cross a line into a friendship. It's called having rapport, where we don't go far enough in our connecting. I think we go too far in pushing, where we actually start crushing, you know, players. Like they need to experience the pressure. That's what we're here for. If we don't show them pressure now here in practice, how will they know in a game? If we don't show them pressure in a game, how are they ever going to get through life? We've got to watch how far we go with that. And the third is, we talk about, well, you got to be honest with these kids, which falls a little bit under the pressure part, and I'm not their friend. I think this is one of the byproducts of both, which is unfiltered, unempathetic, unthought out assessments. Like, I had someone tell me once when I was playing baseball, and I suddenly found myself in a starting lineup. I didn't think I was going to at one point in high school. And all of a sudden I got in my own head and I started worrying about it. And the coach who I'm still friends with this guy today, because he was one of someone's I went to high school with, was her dad. And he and I still have exchanged notes over the recent years. But he said to me, he didn't mean to do this. He just said, Dave, you played yourself into the starting lineup. You know, you did it, but you're playing yourself out. And then he left. I didn't know what to do with that. Because, you know, that playing yourself into the starting lineup, well, that's ancient history. That doesn't matter anymore. So right. He was being honest. Like, in his way, he didn't – I actually don't hold a thing against him. But I think from his generation, as his experience, that type of honesty was what a kid needed to hear. But this kid, I was pretty wrapped up in here, which is why baseball was a hard sport for me to excel at, because you only have 2.5 seconds to do anything, or sometimes half a second to decide. And I think that's what it's really connecting, recognizing when we're not pushing, we're crushing, and when being honest doesn't have to be brutal.
Yeah, and baseball, of all the sports, has the highest percentage of failure. When you think about you going out to bat, you're going to strike out, 70% of the time. So that's a sport that you really have to work on reinforcing the confidence, confidence and empowerment, and, you know, so that kids can deal with that failure when they have it. And one of my biggest beliefs since the beginning of time is praising effort over results, which 20 years later as a coaching, you know, Carol Dweck comes out with an amazing book, Mindset, and it's all about praising effort. I'm like, okay, so I've been doing it right for 20 years, which is good. And I also encourage kids to make mistakes, even in games. And they're like, parents are like, this guy is just like, woo, loco. Like, but if they're not making mistakes, they're never going to develop. They're never going to become creative. Karsh Kuraly is probably the brilliant example of that, where he's got on his whiteboard, you know, make ugly mistakes. And look what he did with the female U.S. volleyball team. So, you know, that in itself is an entire lengthy discussion. So maybe if you can give us a little bit of your terms of background, what exactly is Athletic Legacy Game Plan and what do you do there?
Well, that was where I looked at high school sports as being a huge pivot point, because it reaches down to middle school and club and rec. And then what happens in high school will follow the kids up to what they do in college, whether it's Division I, III, club, or just, you know, intramural, you know, how they learn to lead and deal with things. And what I thought was, well, I get to work with, you know, 20, 40, 60, 80 coaches at a time every time I do a U.S. lacrosse session, which that helps, because I said, well, working with a team, I get to work with 20 kids. I work with U.S. lacrosse, I get, you know, 100 coaches. That's 2,000 kids. But if I can start working with athletic directors who have about 40 teams, each with about 20 kids, now you're looking at how you've got to, you know, help them out, because they can't mentor, even if they want to, all those coaches, especially because they rotate, especially when you get to public schools, like where my kids go, there's a rotating cast of coaches. So the idea was to work with, and I started it with, again, sessions like this, where athletic directors, we get together on the line like this. We talk as a group over, hey, what's in the way of you moving forward? And the whole idea is to move forward.
Yeah.
And strangely, I've actually haven't stopped it, but what's taken a bigger emphasis was something I'm calling game day now, where one athletic director said, hey, what you did for us in that chat, can you do it for my students? I want to pick all my captains that are for this season. and can you sit them down? I'll get two or three laptops out in one room and let's talk through leadership, because I want them to talk about it, experience it during a season. And it went amazing, to be honest. The athletic game day, or the athletic legacy, the whole idea was to really give an athletic director not just their continuing education, the administrative, all those important things, but a support group to talk for a year, you know, over how are things going? What did you try? Here's what I did. And in these short trial runs that I've done, you know, it's been amazing where whether it's the type of students you have or just the individual saying, yeah, I was like you 10 years ago. Hey, I know where you've been. I had that issue with my principal, a parent, a coach. It's amazing where the growth comes from. It's what we talked about earlier. You can't just read it. You got to live it. Just like we don't tell players, look at this film. Go do that. I'll see you at game day. We get them out there on the field and we break it down to pieces and we tell them to go make mistakes. Adults aren't supposed to make mistakes. Right? When you're on the job, coaches, you can't make a mistake. Athletic director, you can't make a mistake. Yet somehow they're supposed to get this figured out. So that's what it is developed to do. It's got about it's got 12 modules to it, but three of them are administrative. And actually, to be honest, I found some other groups that I would rather refer to who really have to get help.
That's their wheelhouse. Yeah.
And it takes them through really how to figure out what's their vision, how to put it in play with their coaches, their players, and even reaching out to their parents, because that's the other, you know, all three of those pieces, they get hit from three sides, athletic directors, but when they have all three going, it's pretty magical. So that's something I've just always felt was so important, because we don't have enough follow-up in any industry. You know, there's continuing ed, and then all of a sudden it's, well, I hope you've learned it. I hope you can apply it. And we're just going to assume it's going to be a happy ending when people really do want more touch points.
Sounds like a great evolution from the coaching. Like, I love the analogy where you gave it about the USA Lacrosse, because I do the same thing for Hockey Canada. You know, 20 coaches, 40 coaches, and my goal, and it's probably a lofty one, as I want to have 10,000 coaches go through my clinics, because each coach coaches 15 players. That equates to a reach of 150,000 kids, which is about 25% of the Hockey Canada membership. And hopefully that will start bringing the competition, because it's just become like the analogy I gave earlier, 8-year-old kids. Kids should not really be worrying about competition, like real competition, until 16, 17, 18. Too early is not good, and that's just going to lead them to quitting. So what about the making the play? You shared some insight at the beginning that kind of scaled it back a bit, but what have been some of your favorite interviews, and what have you learned doing that?
What have I learned? I've learned so much. I've learned how important it is to tap into the sports psychology infrastructure of the country, find the right people. Or even sharing, like, you know, guys like you and I, what rubs off from the other experts we run to, sharing it. So some of the key people, I had Jerry Lynch on, and Dr. Jerry Lynch has got
he's amazing.
A ridiculous number of pro and collegiate national titles. And he's very zen, and I do recommend his books. One of them I know we're going to talk about later, but it's called Coaching with Heart. And, you know, it's one of those things where you read the book and say, that's a lot of great fluff. It's almost all, you know, practically poetry, but that's not the real world. Check his resume.
Yeah, he's working with Golden State Warriors. You know, I didn't reach out to him for the summit. I had John and Reed and James in the summer summit, but I knew that in the fall, like, Jerry is like, you know, he's working with Golden State. He's doing all the other stuff. He's working all these I mean, he's worked with, I think when he shared it, the Way of Champions, it's over 30 different teams have gone to national championships, and all the books he's written. Yeah. I mean, and the way he's doing it is totally, is different than what you expect, but the results prove it. I mean, and he's a big advocate for the whole transformational coaching and servant leadership and all the good stuff that we're aspiring to get to, it's taking time to get there. But that's really, you know, best coaches ever. And you think of the Phil Jacksons of the world, the John Woodens, all those guys, that's the way they coached, you know, top careers. So they truly cared about their players, and the whole concept of loving your players and having them love each other. Well, who would have ever thought that would have been something anyone would have talked about 15, 20 years ago?
Yeah. Another great one, just talking about, you mentioned Wooden, was Jim Ballman. He is, another sports psychologist. He's been with the U.S. Olympic Committee. I mean, he's been in the business for, I think, 50 years or 40 years. And in that discussion, we were, again, talking about all these little nuances. Like people say, oh, John Wooden, the pyramid of success. And I said, I love and I hate that thing, because I see some coaches wearing t-shirts with the whole pyramid and there's 40 things on there.
Yeah.
And it's just too many. And he told me two amazing things. That's what I loved about this show. In, you know, just 30 seconds, he said, well, first, you know, Coach Wooden, I talk with him a lot. You know, he was a little bit younger, but they were contemporaries on the West Coast. And he said, well, you weren't supposed to be able to implement the whole thing at once. It was just, that's the universe. And you just kind of figure out what you're trying to work on, and you see the other things that are related. So it wasn't take on, you know, those 40 elements. Keep it simple.
Yeah.
But more importantly, Coach Wooden, he told about a story where a player, or he related a story that he had a player that just clearly didn't have his usual stuff. And he'd say, you got to pick it up. You got to find it. You got to do it. He just said, where are you at today? He's like, I don't know, coach. I'm feeling like maybe, I don't know why. I just feel like I'm 60, 70% of me. And I'm sorry. He's like, well, don't be sorry, but can you do just one thing? And he said to the player, give me 100% of 70%. That's all I want. And that has stuck with me, because you only have what you have. Okay. The digging deep is to get 100% of what you got. And I think we look at that way, that's hard to do. When you know you're not up to par, yeah, you'll start lowering the bar lower. So this is 100. This is where you can be. We start to sink, because it doesn't feel good to not be up here.
Yeah.
But the digging gets us back to the best we can be today. You can't be more than you are on a given day. And that was one of the most powerful things. In those shows, yeah, about 60 of them, we've gone from being, you know, every other week to monthly. I really just did a point where when I see people like yourself, I go, this is a really good profile that people need to have in this library to find some help. But those, no doubt, were two of my favorites.
Yeah, I mean, anybody I talk to about John, it's amazing how many people now, because I've traveled the country, have had the opportunity to either meet him. Gordon Bloom, who's part of this this summit, he shares some great anecdotes. And when I chat with him, it's like, wow, him and Wade Gilbert were in a car with him, driving him to and from a conference, 45 minutes each way in LA traffic, an hour and a half with John Wooden. Like, can you imagine that? And he shared all kinds of amazing anecdotes. And it was like, wow. And the thing I loved about John is his pyramid of success is kind of, you know, a lot of people talk about it, but he never used the word winning, and even though he was such an accomplished coach and all the things he did, the NCAA, you know, 10 national championships, that had that winning streak, 2.5 years, 88 games. But winning was never his focus. It was about developing his athletes into men. And that's all he ever talked about, and the accomplishments, that not the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's or Bill Walton's that are going on in the NBA, is all the rest of them, what they achieved when they went on after their collegiate careers. And that's what made him such an amazing coach, is the contribution and the positive legacy he left behind.
Yeah, and that word legacy, that's why when I put together this program for athletic directors, I call it the athletic legacy game plan, because that's what you're creating, and it's the legacy through athletics. But it's not about what the teams are doing. It's about what they're doing long after you're done.
Yeah, and coaches do their job the right way. And it's my tagline, they're not a kid's last coach. If they don't do it the right way, and sadly a lot of them make mistakes early on, those kids are going to pull out and pull out early. It's sad how many parents and kids I've talked to over the last 15 years that a lot of them quit because of a coach. And I'm like, man, there's got to be a better way to do this so that we don't have that happening and taking it too high of a competition level too early so kids love the game. So that kind of precursors my next question. What can coaches do so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning?
I think keep your goals real simple. I've already been planning for the spring lacrosse and trying to see how few words and how few bullet points I can get my goals for the season, because it gets to be confusing, which gets to be frustrating. So I think simple, I mean, get it down to the essence of what do you want to see them do. And one of the things I've decided for my team this year is they're 60-minute games. And typically on a lacrosse field, there's three zones you tend to run in. They happen to be about 60 yards long. And I want 60 minutes of everybody covering their 60 yards nonstop. And I want them run until they're blue and come off. And I'm going to put them right back on. I don't want people coasting. And because from that, I know all good things will come. They will be in shape. They will be taking great chances. They will be playing for each other. And they won't care what the score is. They won't care how many minutes they have. And when you have a selfless team that only cares about, you know, the play in front of them, the wins are going to come. So that's really what I think is when you get it, keep it simple about making them, you know, trust that when you take them off, there's a reason. And when you ask them to do something, you know, stretch, it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
And again, simplicity leads to trust, because when I've complicated things, and my engineering brain can certainly do that, I can come up with more bullet points and sub points. It's hard to connect with the kid because of that, and therefore you don't have the trust back and forth.
Yeah, and when you're a high-level thinker and or a high-level athlete coming down to coaching, I use the analogy of Wayne Gretzky. He saw the game unlike any other player I've ever witnessed in my life. What he did behind that net and how he slowed the game down in his brain, like probably saw it in slow motion. But when he came down to coaching, he couldn't bring his brain down. And that's that whole analogy, the curse of knowledge. And many coaches that start out whatever sport it is, whether it be lacrosse or baseball or hockey, soccer, that played that sport, say, to a high level, come down, they're coaching 5 to 6 year olds. Like when I started coaching hockey, it's like, how did I learn how to stop? How did I learn how to pass? How did I, you know, get up when I fell down? Like you're just like, oh my God, I got to go back in time and remember all that stuff. And that's the sad thing about today's coaching world. If the coaches are not trained to do that, they'll just immediately jump to tactics and systems and strategies and not keep it simple for those kids so that they love the game more. And the ultimate, I think the ultimate measure of a great coach is when every kid comes back the following year.
Yeah.
That to me is the measure.
Yeah. And for me personally, I'll have to say the fact that I always was good enough to get myself just barely into the next level and get myself into trouble as an athlete was a huge gift. It was frustrating then because they'd say, sure, you can go to the next level, but I was fighting to keep up, whether it was size or speed or, you know, field IQ, whatever it was. But I look back on that and I go, oh yeah, that's what most of them are thinking. You know, most of them. And for that, it helps me to be more relaxed and to connect and to not, again, to only demand 100% of whatever percent they brought to the field that day.
Yeah, it's a great analogy. And it's, I had another coach that I talked to actually in the summit, Darren Windsor. He's in Australia. He talked about drills and he goes, you know, coaches need to understand they need to disguise their drills. And I'm like, that's a brilliant way to do this. He goes, if they do if they do something where they're learning a skill, they're having fun doing it, and it's disguised as like just fun playtime. And I have a few of those drills that I did for a number of years that kids learn a ton. They don't know what they're learning. Parents kind of look at it and go, and then I'll explain to them and say that they learned how to do edge work. They had to learn fire in the belly. They had to learn balance, agility, all just by doing like a goofiest drill that I learned this from Bobby Orr does a program with Mike Bossy and Cassie Campbell Pascal called Safe and Fun Hockey. Mm-hmm. And there was a drill that we did when they had a girls' jamboree that I helped coach at. Vicky Sakura was in net and Cassie was on the other end, and we put a rubber chicken on the ice. And the girls had to come and like go through cones and pines. It was basically a puck race, but they had to go grab that rubber chicken with their gloves and then go and throw it into the net. And Vicky's in the net and she's just like laughing so hard. But man, what these girls learned. And so I stole that drill and I used it for about 3 or 4 years until the guy that my boys got to about bantam. And it was like, nah, because when they went for that rubber chicken, they were just like, it was more of a wrestling match than anything else. So disguising it, you know, how we word our things and the semantics can make a significant change in how we coach.
Yeah. And I'll say the young co-trainers that I've worked with at US Lacrosse, and we go to these things together and we learn from each other. And a lot of them, thankfully, are 20 somethings and 30 somethings from the modern women's game. And they understand today's teenagers better. They've all been doing games. So this is what is really encouraging for those that don't think, you know, games as opposed to drills work. It's taking place at the collegiate level. It's been taking place and it's now spreading because those, you know, most, especially on the women's side, there's no paycheck, you know, for sports. Title IX, you got to play. There just isn't a whole lot. It's worse than the men. So they're giving back by coming to coach club and high school and, you know, the national orgs, but they're now exposing us to the fact that, yeah, it's okay at the highest level. National champions are having fun on the field. And some, you know, and they keep winning.
Yeah. And if you have fun, the winning is a byproduct. And if you look at any professional sports team that won, look at the Boston Red Sox and Alex Cora and how he led that team. They win the championship, but every one of them said, yeah, he was a great communicator. He treated us with respect. We had a ton of fun. And like the NHL last year when Ovi finally wins the Stanley Cup, we had a ton of fun. Like that word gets thrown around a lot. And a lot of people think when you use the word fun, that kids mean goofing off. Well, no, and most of them will say they don't like when their teammates are goofing off, but healthy competition, which is a lot of what we've talked about, is fun. And there's nothing better for me than like a 0-0 game in hockey. Like that's fun, you know, when the defense are just playing amazing, the goalie's playing amazing, and that one goal that gets scored, it can be a deal breaker. But that whole competition for me is what I loved about all the sports. And where I laugh is a lot of people don't understand in free play, we're probably more competitive than we are in a structured game with a scoreboard. Like you're talking about your buddies when you went and played pond hockey. I played tackle basketball with my buddies, and you know, like that was pretty intense, but it was what we were all about.
Right. And you know, when you said tackle basketball, people, you did not hear wrong there. We called it mall ball, where it was friendly. You could wrap a guy up and you'd make up rules. Again, and the idea was not to hurt people. It just was, we're going to have a lot of fun being incredibly tense, incredibly competitive in somebody's driveway and doing some pretty amazing things. Like, and you'd say, how on earth did you get that shot off and in? But we weren't trained athletes. We were just kids playing.
Yeah.
We were doing things that would make ESPN's highlight reel every night.
Yeah. And sadly, because there's so much structure and that's what I love about the analogy you're giving at the national, like at the collegiate level, they've really bought into the athletic or the American development model. Small area games is really how I've coached forever. Skill stations that are fun, battle drills that are fun, instilling the confidence, and no matter what sport, because I've coached a lot of the contact sports, but also non-contact. Without that, you're probably not going to keep these kids going beyond a year. And secondly, they're not really going to develop the core skills because it's too structured. And that's one of the biggest criticisms that many sports have had is you've got to get rid of the structure and you got to incorporate more free play. Because when you and I both grew up, that was our lives. Like there was no internet at the time. You know, it was free play, free play, free play. So how do kids get that now? Well, we've got to incorporate it in practices.
Yeah. And in fact, I'll so we don't get into too many of these, but one of the things, drills I thought I came up with, but it turns out that a lot of other coaches did the same thing for lacrosse, which was, especially for girls, and the reason it's important for youth is they don't have a pocket. So it's really hard to pick up that ball and keep it. We would basically, if you had 12 girls, you throw out 11 balls as far as you can. It sounds sadistic. I'd throw them with, you know, with my stick as far as I could, 60, 70, 80 yards. And okay, girls, go get one. Whoever doesn't make it back with the ball has to sit out. And we would just do it till the end. And it's one way to get them to run, and they learn to dodge, and then they learn to scoop in traffic, and you learn to chase the girl down. But here's the thing. They would say, can we do it again? And I honestly did it just because I didn't know what else to do with them. And I said, all right, I just got to kill a whole bunch of time. And I've mentioned that to some coaches. They go, I did that too for the same reasons. And it turns out they love it because, and again, they were absolutely fierce. These girls were running that their knees were wobbly at the end. Everybody, the last two, everybody else was on their feet cheering for them. They didn't care that they were out. And it was the best of everything, from the most low-tech, ridiculous, unintended, you know, teaching moment that became a staple of what I do.
Yeah, and kids loved it, right? And they're cheering on. There's so is building team chemistry and bonding and all the skill and plus conditioning without bag skating, you know, like a whole bunch of positives that you got out of it than not. So some rapid-fire questions. What's your favorite book that you would recommend to coaches or a resource?
Inside Out Coaching, Joe Ehrman. No doubt. The gist of it, are you a transactional or a transformational coach? It's that simple. An incredibly revealing book about himself. But honestly, you read that book, it's going to change your life.
Yeah, it's a great one. It's one of my top five for sure. And the whole transactional, I kind of use the app. I know John O'Sullivan tries to, the knowledgeable coach more so in the transaction, but the transformational is that soul servant leadership and really connecting with your players and understanding the importance of individual versus team and all that other stuff. That's the evolution of coaching as I see it. The emotional intelligence is coming into play. But it's going to take time for it to trickle down to the youth sports level. As you've seen, you know, now you've got these national athletes say it's okay to play games and practices at this level because that's what we do, right? So what about for parents, books or resources? What would you recommend?
Boy, you know, the funny thing is the books that I think are best for coaches are the ones parents should read too, because you got to understand what you want from a coach and the fact that how you're treating your kid when they get in the car afterwards. But one I would add to it, this is not a sports book. It's called The Coaching Habit by a Canadian, Michael Bungay Stanier. It is about asking questions. You don't tell people what to do. You ask questions, and before you know it, they're figuring it out on their own. And it is one of the best ways. Now, parents, watch out for that because you got to watch – they're not pointed questions like, why'd you do that? Mm-hmm. But it's very simple. It's the art of asking almost open-ended questions that lead to a conversation. It leads to self-discovery. It leads to a rapport. It leads to connection. And it's terribly well-written. I mean, it's just you'll absorb it. It's based on a lot of great management books, but it feels nothing like a management book. And again, I use it on the field. I use it with coaches. I use it with adults, 25 to 65 years old in the workplace. It's, I would look into that. It's a great one.
Yeah, that's a great recommendation. And I agree that parents should dive in a little bit more into understanding the coach books or leadership books that we are reading so that they can kind of understand why we do what we do, especially things like long-term athletic development, ADM in the U.S., that's been a huge shift in concept in the last 10 years or so. In Canada, many organizations, our national sport organization, is still only now kind of rolling out those models where I'll get, like, I run a lot of hockey clinics from September to mid-December. And if I have 40 coaches in a room and I ask them who's heard of LTAD, LTPD, that's our acronym versus ADM, I might have five hands that go up. I'm like, whoa. And has anybody heard of physical literacy? Nobody hands go up. Fundamental movement skills. Everybody knows what that is, right? Like, yeah, oh, maybe four or five. So it's, we have our work to do because a lot of those coaches, and that's the whole reason why I'm putting on these summits, is to help those ones that are starting out, grassroots moms and pops that, like, when you started coaching, you were scared. When I first started, everybody, when they first start coaching, it's like you're kind of forced into it because nobody else put their hand up, for one. Two, the parents will applaud you for putting your hand up, but then, you know, 2 months into the season, I'll never forget it. We were coaching five-year-old kids in hockey, and it was initiation. And I had a bunch of parents come to me and said, when are we going to start playing games? And I'm like, they can't even stand on their skates right now. We can't play games yet, but we'll try to incorporate some fun stuff. Like, we always did stuff like asteroids. You always do fun stuff in those practices, but that's why I just carried it forward all the way through. Like, I had midget 16, 17-year-old rugby players like, hey, we're going to play. Yeah, just go out there and let's play sevens. Let's go play sevens for half an hour. They learned a ton, right? So, okay, what do you have a favorite TED Talk that may be coaching or just in general leadership-wise?
Well, I don't watch too many of them, but the one that always comes to mind is Reed Maltby's.
Yeah.
Little spoiler, he brings a kid on the stage, and fortunately it's
his son.
Yeah, and he treats him the way you shouldn't treat a kid, but too often we see it.
Yeah.
And Reed's been such a great friend. I think that's why it also sticks with me, because he's the person that got me a whole bunch of guests for my podcast. When I started, I just said, hey, you do what I want to do. What do you think? And he says, let's talk. Now he's like, yeah, there's not too many people. And I saw his TEDx and I'm like, wow, he's genuine, absolutely genuine. And it's, then the topic itself is so important to just really step back almost out of body and see what we might look like as parents or coaches interacting with our players and kids.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it's one of the most, I had an opportunity when we did our speaker training for Changing the Game. We're in Bend, Oregon. We actually, John, the four or five of us, we went for a hike like along the river, and we chatted for like probably an hour and a half. He's such an amazing, and all the things that he's done since that point. I'm so happy where we've all kind of evolved. Like, that was 3 years ago now. So it's a great TED. John's is also another great TED Talk for parents and coaches. My favorite, aside from theirs, is John Wooden's. When he's sitting in the chair and he just starts rattling off all the poetry, I'm like, wow. And just how smart he was. And the hearing stuff like from Gordon Bloom and Wade Gilbert about being in the car with him at 90 years old, he's still sharp as a tack. And the importance of lifelong learning with him and Claire Drake, how they were going to conferences and like they go and do their talk. And then they go sit in the stands with the coaches and they pull out a notepad and they're still writing notes like in their 80s. Like, lifelong learning, that's the key. That's the whole objective that we're trying to accomplish and plant that seed with coaches instead of, hey, you just took a clinic like that you ran for U.S. lacrosse or I ran for hockey. I tell every one of them, this is just the beginning of your journey. Now, every year, make sure that you continue to add to your tool basket. So that kind of precursors the last two questions. What can coaches do to engage parents on their team versus dealing with them? Because that's probably 50% of coaches ask me that all the time. What's your tips for that?
Wow. For that, again, it's, you're going to have to put something out there to draw them towards you. Let them offer their trust to you. There's rules that you need to say, like, this is due with the 24-hour rule. You know, you can't talk to me about playing time for 24 hours, or your child must be there. There's all those rules, which are good. But I think you have to decide how you're going to treat those players, tell the parents, you know, this whole idea of it's about learning. It's about discovery. It's about who they're going to be when they're done. Put yourself out there, but then be careful. you know, that check your mouth just wrote, you know, as they say, can your butt cash it in there or are you going to be in trouble? Yeah. And so I think the thing that you have to think out, think through again, the things that you want to have happen, do you know how to do them? And then sing it really loud and bring the coaches or the parents in to say, yeah, you know what I saw out there? Like, you shouldn't really talk about another player, but I'll just say, man, did you see him out there? They did this play where they totally screwed it up at the end, but boy, they really stretched it. That's lacrosse. None of this, just run it and hurl it. I said, that was the coolest thing I've seen. And from there, they, you know, when you can pull out specific things, not like, you know, the sound bites, which are, well, we're going to have to tighten it up a little bit, but you know, the key is they all put a great effort into it. I mean, there's nothing about their kid. There's nothing about a kid. They don't know if you really are connecting with their kid. And I think from there, then I've had parents come up to me and say, hey, she's upset. And they trusted me enough to tell me, I said, really, then I need to talk to her. And this was a 9-year-old girl. And I'll just end on this story here. I had too many players on the field. And I just said, you got to get off. You got to get off. And she was really confused. And I just said, yeah, you needed to be off the field. And she wasn't the one that was extra. She just was nearest. That's all it was. Yeah. But the way I told her, I said, you needed to get off the field. We had too many. That was because of you. And the parent said, she's a little upset. And, but they knew where my heart was. And I said, okay. So I took a knee. I said, what did I do? And she told me, she's like, I wasn't the one. And she like broke it right down to, I was playing this position. Then so-and-so came off, someone on. And she really had it down. She's like, it wasn't me. I was doing what I was. I said, you are right. I needed somebody off. I didn't explain it. And, you know, it was a big moment there, as simple as that was, but it was because I told the parents, and again, that year of coaching, I had followed my second daughter from first grade all the way up to seventh grade of coaching. Then I went back to kid number three, all the way back down to second graders. And I learned a lot. So I brought with me a cycle of how to deal with kids and their parents and know what I wanted to do and could say it and could deliver. And, cause I'll tell you the first time through, no, I had a parent that was really upset with me. And when I wanted to try and talk to her, she just said, no, I refuse to talk to you. So just 4 years earlier, my first trip through the ladder of all the age groups, I didn't have that rapport. I don't blame myself for anything. I just didn't know how or how important it was to really have your intentions out there and clear, so that parents can find simple ways to trust you, not about minutes, but honestly, just about knowing their kid, being able to point out little things, and why it was so cool, so important.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of nailed it on the head, is the importance of connecting not just with your players, but also connecting with the parents. I mean, if you're coaching youth sports, whether it's high school or 5-year-olds or everything in between, there is going to be a parent or a guardian involved in some capacity. As now in this day and age in the U.S., particularly with a $17 billion industry in youth sports, there's a lot of money at stake. So the parents are going to have high expectations. So the sooner that you figure out tips and ways to engage them in lieu of alienating them, I think your season is going to be a lot better. So a great, great parent meeting to start the season, continuously ongoing communication. There's a whole bunch of myriad of tips and tricks. And you kind of almost got into this last question with that answer, but I'll just, if you coach now for how many years?
Let's see, 12. Okay, and, so, you know, multiple seasons a year. So yeah, I've probably got about a good 15, 16 seasons in.
Okay, so look back in year one, that year that you first started out. What would you recommend now, knowing what you know after 15 years and also your level as a coach developer with, you know, Positive Coaching Alliance and US? Look, what would you recommend to coaches that are just put their hand up, they're starting to coach with their 5-6-year-old kids so that they can shave 5 years off their learning curve?
It's, you keep it simple, but work back from the outcome. Like, this is what I want to see. Okay. But what For instance, I want to see fast movement. I want to see everybody sliding, helping, doing. What does that mean, though? Okay, that means they need to be in shape. What does that mean? That means they need to be engaged in every drill. What does that mean? They need to be having fun, and I need to keep it simple, because when I overcomplicate it, they couldn't find the fun, and they all weren't tuned in. And then that took my energy from not praising and jumping in and correcting and having some more fun with the kids to trying to say, hey, pay attention, pay attention, pay attention. So, and that's what I was doing literally last night, because I've been working on it since September and it still wasn't simple enough. And I think I've got it there, because I need to have as few commands in my head, like one word, not four versions of what to do, because that's confusing, or I say the wrong thing. Just simple and clear. The games, you really only need it. The fundamentals truly are everything. I mean, if they, the whole idea is, you know, defense, know where they are. Offense, move the ball around, know if you're helping, you know, what do you do, on ball, off ball, transition game. Okay, well, if they're coming at you, we got to slow them. If you're taking it up the field, don't lose it. I mean, it's really that simple. There's a whole bunch of other things that get in there, but when we get into all those details, the kids lose track of, so all you wanted me to do was use my own brain to figure out how to keep it to the other end of the field based on the situation? Yes, that was all I wanted, but I threw 13 different situations at you, and they'll say, well, I thought I was supposed to pass it. I thought I was supposed to run it. And I've overcomplicated things, you know? So simple, what's the essence of your sport at that level? You know, that's the other part too, is really, what's it really matter for that level of play to be successful? Again, I don't do things at the JV level that the varsity coach does, you know, or the same type of ways, because it's not appropriate. Cause I do have players that they played a little bit of rec, or they're a great athlete and figured they'd like to try it. So mm-hmm. I have to go about it differently, but simply.
Yeah, they keep a simple analogy. Like one of the things I've recommended to a lot of coaches is that the best thing you can do as a coach, especially the younger age groups, is not coach. Games particularly, just watch. That's their cherry time. Just let them play. Just let them go out there. Because early on, the first 5 years, I see all these coaches, and it doesn't matter what sport it is, they're screaming at the top of those lungs. They may not be derogatory or insulting. It's like they're screaming instructions to like 5, 6, 7-year-old kids that are, and they're like, that's the worst thing you could do. You should just be quiet, observe. You can't control games. No matter if you're, especially young age groups, you shouldn't even be playing games. There shouldn't be no scoreboard. 9, 10, 11 years old, when you start playing games, watch, observe. And if you are going to give them any feedback, ask them what they saw. Because what they see is differently what you saw, what the parents saw, and all this other stuff. But sometimes not coaching is better than anything, because they're playing the game the way they want to play it. And the decision-making, which is one of the biggest issues we have today, is too much structure. They're going to make their decisions. They may not be the right one, but at least they're going to make decisions, which is what we're trying to encourage them. So I've had all kinds of answers to that question, but like, keep it simple. We can't say keep it simple, that, you know, which in our generation, because that's what that to me, a mentor coach that I had, and he was probably the most amazing man. He coached my daughter in softball, and I helped coach the team for years. We'd sit in the dugout while the girls were warming up for practices or games, and I'd pick his brain. I was always like, give me a nugget. And then he goes, you know, hockey, we talk hockey and softball all the time. Hockey for me is a really simple game. He coached and played it for years. He's in the a recreational hall of fame, blah, blah, blah. He goes, I don't get these coaches that have all these systems and tactics and strategies, because the team that has the puck, that shoots the puck more, the skates faster than the other team, that does just the basic things really, really well, they're probably winning the game. And you say that all the time. And I'm like, keep it simple. Keep it simple. Yep. Get rid of the tactics and strategies. Focus on skill. Teach them how to skate. Teach them how to be balanced. Teach them how to be agile. Shoot, pass, and get rid of the selfish play And I was like, it was such a brilliant anecdote, but he say that all the time. Keep it simple. Keep it simple. And he could have coached to the highest level, and he just kept the things I learned. Sally passed away, and that's when both me and my daughter got out of softball because we just couldn't be near a ball field. But yeah, it was amazing how what you learn. So I love that we're trying to do the hard stop at the 60-minute. We kind of carried over that. This is a great chat. I loved some of the anecdotes that you shared. I mean, hopefully you can keep going with your radio show and podcast, because I'm learning a ton. Like, I've now interviewed, I'm up to 36 people in the last 6 months, and everybody shared all kinds of great nuggets. Like, I'm just writing them down like crazy. So thanks for doing this. It was great.
Yeah. It's an amazing community of coaches out there and parents that want to share. So thanks again for letting me be able to, you know, give my thoughts, because it helps me refine, but also I took a lot of yours right back in. And that's what this is all about. We don't flatline. We just keep getting better, you know, wherever we are. I don't ever want to stop getting better. That's not good.
Yeah. And one of the greatest analogies about Jerry, first way champions conference, we all joked, and he did it again. I didn't make the second one. I went to the third one. But the first conference, we were in Boulder, Colorado, and we were in this gymnasium, and it's 105 degrees outside. Like, there's no air conditioning. And that was the one thing that John – and we went back to that same place this year, but the temperature was cooler. And on the Friday night, Jerry gets up on his stool, you know, his infamous perch, right? So, and all of us middle-aged coaches are sitting on a gymnasium hardwood floor, and we're all like, oh, my God, you know, bad knees, bad back, stuff like that. He gets up there, and he goes, I'm going to tell you a little story. And we're like, where's he going with this? He goes, you know, I've been at this for 37 years, and I'm only halfway there. And I'm like, whoa. And everybody looks around, halfway there, like all the things he's accomplished, the books, the working with the professional athletes, all the NCAA. I knew some of the history through John. I'm like, only halfway there. He goes, that's so much to learn. And the greatest thing that I learned is I'm not making a living. And even though he's probably getting paid pretty well for what he does, he goes, I learned long ago that coaching is not about making a living. Coaching is about making a difference. And the sooner that you recognize that's what you and your role is, that's your calling, your purpose, if you like, make a difference by developing youth into adults. And it was like, boom, the light bulb. That was 3 years ago. I still think about it like it was yesterday. I still think about the pain in my knee as we're all getting up. But it was unbelievable how that transformed my thought process of looking at the whole coaching world and trying to relate this to coaches so that they in turn do the same thing. Because that's really the business we're all in, is helping these kids not only become great athletes, but great people.
Yeah, and you've infected me now. Like, I feel like I was there. I think that's a perfect way to close on this, because if we're not here for something far bigger than ourselves, we should go back to the stands and just watch the game.
Yeah, and your last takeaway, Bob Mancini is one of the people that I interviewed. He's with USA Hockey, and I asked him a question, what's the number one tip? And he goes, we got to keep in perspective for the kids. And it was actually, you know, that's all I've been saying. Remember why you're doing this. You're not doing it for ego. You're not doing it to make money. You're most of the volunteers. Like, you have a full-time job. I'm trying to make a living doing this, but who knows? It's all about those kids. And hopefully they have big smiles on their faces when they show up during and at the end of the season, and they come back next year. Then you know you did your job right.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook, For Love of the Game, Twitter, and forlovethegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.